From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Delighted to welcome back to the show the wonderful Paul Jones. Nice to see you, Paul.
A wonderful Paul Jones. Thank you very much, John.
The reason we're getting together is that your first four albums with the Manfred Manns just been released on CD and a posh box vinyl set, yes?
That's right, yes, about which we're very excited.
I'm sure.
Because, the artwork and everything has been sort of reproduced perfectly. In fact, possibly even improved on. And you get a little book that comes with it, you know. And I don't know what's in it, but I'm sure it's all true. Ha ha. And, it is a very handsome production, the box, which is why it costs more than the four CDs put together.
I was going to say to you, when we used to buy vinyl as kids, right? I don't know, about 31 shillings or £1.11 or whatever, weren't they?
£1.12 and 6, I remember.
Really?
32 and sixpence. And for that, you could get a wonderful album by whoever it might be, Thelonious Monk or Elvis Presley, you know. But they weren't very long, were they?
No.
The technology wasn't as good as it became later.
I ought to say, Paul Jones, singer, harmonica wizard, actor, TV presenter, DJ, radio presenter, practicing Christian. That sums you up, doesn't it?
Yes, that's got most of it there, I think.
And of course, years ago, Paul Jones, you wanted to be a runner, didn't you? Many, many years ago.
Only for a little while after I saw a film starring Burt Lancaster.
Right.
And he was, I can't remember what that film is called now, and probably I would think it was awful if I saw it. No, actually, I always thought he was a somewhat underrated actor, actually. But anyway, I thought he was absolutely wonderful in that, and I thought, yes, that's me. And
real movie stars in those days, didn't we?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I suppose they've got real ones nowadays,
but
our tastes sometimes don't keep up.
Right. Born in Hampshire, of course.
Drayton.
Yes, I know where Drayton is,
And the first school that I went to was Solent Road.
Was it?
In Drayton, yes.
Eventually you went to Portsmouth Grammar, which is quite a well-known school, isn't it, really?
Yes, in fact, it's probably more well-known now than it was then, even. It's certainly grown, because when I was at school there, there were 600 pupils, all male. And I thought, that school is huge. Now they have over 2,000 pupils, and most of them are girls. So it's kind of changed a lot of character. And the man who's been headmaster for quite a lot of years, James Priory, has just left, I believe.
Has he?
Yes.
Then, of course, later you went to Edinburgh Academy and, for a while, Oxford.
Yes, for a while.
Yes. You nicely, didn't actually graduate, did
nicely
you?
Put. Now, I failed my prelims after two terms. And they said we could stay on and have another term to sort of catch up and get it right this time. And more and more and more, all that time, I was falling in love with not just music, but the whole world of being a musician. And so I did less work in that third term than I had in the previous two. I never went back, actually, to see if I had got anywhere, but I don't think I would have.
I know in the early days you loved black American singers, Nat King Cole, Sammy Davis, Mahalia Jackson. Were they, looking back, were they a great influence on your life in a way?
Yes, huge influence. In fact, the whole question of racial equality and quality of opportunity and all that sort of stuff, that was massively influential to me. And actually trying to sound like... I was trying to sound like people who have... much higher voices than me,
right.
Which is pointless, really. Sam Cooke, Marvin Gaye, all those people, they're all tenors, and I've never been a tenor. Baritone, yes. Baritone plus falsetto. So I was just imitating people for a long, long time, and imitating them out of sheer idolatry, really. I mean, I just worshipped them, and that was foolish as well.
Thunder Odin, when did that come in then?
Thunder Odin?
Yeah.
I said, I got hold of a LaRousse encyclopedia of mythology. And I was looking for a name, because I actually had this undergraduate band. Well, actually, mostly undergraduates. Some of them weren't. Some of them were townies, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, Odin, the Norse god of thunder. One of my favorite records in those days, I had a 78 RPM shellac record of it, was by Lightning Hopkins and Thunder Smith. And, you know, I've actually forgotten the name of the two pieces of music, one on each side, but I've got them on CD now. But in those days, when they first put them out, Smith wasn't really called Thunder Smith at all. The record company gave him that name so they could put the record out as Thunder and Lightning.
Oh, I see.
And I thought that was really rather good. And I thought, oh, Thunder, yes. I shall be Thunder. And then I thought, you know, I need a surname, and I made it Odin. But it's tautology, because Thunder and Odin mean exactly the same thing, the Norse god of thunder.
And Elmo Lewis featured in your early life, of course, Brian Jones.
Yeah, that was Brian. I suppose it was Elmo because of Elmore James, although there was somebody else who was called Elmo. I can't remember who it was now. And Lewis was actually Brian's real name, or one of his names. And I don't know, I always think that we ran into each other at the Alexis Corner Club in Ealing, but it must have been before that, because he was the person who told me that Alexis had opened the club and, you know, we ought to go there on Saturdays. And we did. He lived in Cheltenham at that time, and I was still living in Oxford, even though I was no longer a student. I was living with one. he lives in Cheltenham, and so he would kind of make his way from Cheltenham to Oxford, which was on the way to Ealing, where Alexis's club was every Saturday night. And he would generally come on Fridays, and we would find a party to gate crash, where he would play guitar and I would maybe play some harmonica, but mostly sing. And so there we were, kind of flailing about. And then one day he rang me up and he said, right, we've not been taking this thing seriously. From now on, I'm taking it seriously. I'm moving to London, I'm getting a flat, I'm starting a band, and I'm going to become rich and famous. Do you want to be my singer? And I said, no. Well, my band was actually getting some gigs at the time, but also I'd auditioned for a position of singing with a dance band.
Really?
Called Gordon Rees and the Adelphians. And they were called the Adelphians because they mostly worked at the Adelphi in Slough, which was obviously a sort of leisure centre and had a ballroom. And that's where they played. And I got that job, and there were loads and loads of people after it. I'm not saying that I got it because I was better than any of them, but at least I was the only one who didn't sing a Cliff Richard song in my audition. Anyway, I got that gig. And so I had just been told, A, I had that gig, and B, the agent who had set up the auditions and decided that I was the man for the job promised me that he would move my career along nicely by moving me into a bigger agency or whatever it might be. Actually, he did none of those things. All his promises came to hot air. But nonetheless, I had a position of at least one gig a week, two some weeks, and the Adelphians were all wonderful musicians. Yeah. They were people who would have been playing jazz if they'd got enough money to do so, but they understood chords and chord progressions and memorizing them so that you know what's coming next, and I learned a lot from those guys.
Of course, going back, Paul, before rock and roll, it was all big bands, wasn't it, really, sort of?
Oh, absolutely. Big bands and then small bands within the big bands. And then, of course, the small band version of the big band as the big band became increasingly financially unviable. That wasn't just Britain. I mean, that happened everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Count Basie wound up with a seven-piece group.
Amazing, isn't it?
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
My current guest is Paul Jones.
I bet you enjoyed touring with the Crystals, which was an early tour for Bamford Man, wasn't it?
It was. It was the very first national tour that we did. Headline was Joe Brown and the Brothers. And also big on the bill was Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. So that's where we met not only Johnny Kidd, but also some of those other guys like Mick Green, the guitarist, who became a great friend of ours, and Howard Conder, who was a brother behind Joe Brown, and he's still a friend of mine. He's still with us. Mick Green is not still with us. And of course, yes, the Crystals. I loved playing for the Crystals.
Yeah, I bet.
But it was embarrassing because we had been hired originally to play for everybody who didn't have a full band of their own, which was everybody except for Johnny Kidd and Joe Brown. And there were several other people on the bill. And in the meantime, we had this top five record, big record. And our manager said to the tour people, well, you know, the boys can't be backing people that haven't had hit records when they have. So they absolutely excused us from backing all those people. But they said, but you still got to do the Crystals. I said, yes, we should. We will. And so we backed them. But we did, unfortunately, still have some teenage girls screaming for us while we were just playing behind the Crystals, which can't have amused the Crystals very much.
I know you sort of shook the pot world in 66 when you decided to leave. Did you want to be a sort of a front man? Did you want to be a star? Was that something in your thinking at that time?
Well, it wasn't so much being a star, although a lot of people were saying to me, is that all the money you make from being the lead singer of all those hit records? And the thought did occur to me, slowly but surely, that is a bit ridiculous, actually. But the other thing was, and this was very important to me, when we started, we played blues. We played some jazz, and we played a little bit of soul. Now, nowadays, all that stuff is called music of black origin. I was interested in music of black origin. I wasn't interested in anything else. Even those things which nowadays people call pop music, they were all done by black singers. Doo-Wah Diddy?
Yes.
The Exciters. Sha-la-la, the Crystals. Oh No, Not My Baby, Maxine Brown. Come Tomorrow, Marie Knight. All black artists. So to me, that was what I wanted to do. And all of a sudden, these other things started creeping into the repertoire.
Right. You know?
Let's rehearse this. Must we?
So it wasn't all harmony then, Paul, really?
Leaving, you mean?
Well, when you were in the group, sometimes if you wanted one thing and someone wanted another, or...
No, there wasn't any disharmony, any, what do you call it, the sound chaos... No, there wasn't any of that, really. Cacophony. Actually, there were some moments of contretemps in the group, but usually they didn't involve me. I don't like to do contretemps. It's not really me. Anyway, the contretemps really started when I said, guys, I want to leave.
Yes.
Too many pop songs being offered to the group, and I was trying to fight them off, and other people were trying to sort of get them into the repertoire. And really, to be honest, it was time for them to get Mike Darbo. But it took them a whole year. No, I'll exaggerate. It was over 9 months, though, between my telling them I wanted to leave. And they said, well, will you stay until we find somebody we like to replace you? And I said, of course I will. Never thinking that it would be sort of 9 months and two more weeks. But it was. But anyway, Mike Darby was definitely the right bloke.
Hi, Chill Blades. It's Nick Frisbee here saying John Hannam is a puppet.
So there you were with a solo career, and you had a couple of solo hits, didn't you? And then A lot of people were surprised when Conduct Unbecoming came along and you actually auditioned for that, didn't you? And you got the part.
I did. As a matter of fact, I did that Australian tour with The Who and The Small Faces. I came back from that thinking, there must be something that a grown man can do for a living, which isn't this. And all of a sudden my phone rang and it was a man called Charles Marowitz, who was sort of the enfant terrible of the theatre world at that time. He was a director. He was also a theoretician who had written books on the subject of what acting ought to be and all that sort of stuff. And he rang me up and he said, I've been let down by an American actor and I've run out of American and Canadian actors in the United Kingdom. And it occurred to me that because you sing songs with an American accent, you could perhaps do this. So he auditioned my American accent.
Did he?
Yes, he did. I passed, and then he said, right, let's talk about what acting really is. He said, what acting is not is pretending. It's really funny because nowadays that is still an argument or a heated discussion between this actor and that actor, as to whether it's pretending or not pretending. I mean, some of the finest actors working in Britain these days will say, of course it's pretending, what are you talking about? Others will say, no, it's living in a hypothetical situation, which is an entirely different matter.
Yes.
And anyway, so Charles Marowitz taught me that, and I did 2 one-act plays for him, and I got quite decent reviews. And so I said to my agent, right, this is my new career I've got. What can I do? And he said, I'll get you some more auditions. So he got me an audition for Conduct Unbecoming. I failed it. And I failed it for one very, very simple reason. They'd asked me to read a particular part, which is called The Junior Subaltern, in case anybody knows the piece. And he gave me one page. I had no idea what the story was. All I had was that one page they gave me. And I looked at these speeches and I thought, it's obviously a comic role. And I did the audition. And of course, it's anything but comic. It's a thriller, you know, with no comedy in it, whatever. And the most comic moment in it was when Jeremy Clyde fell over backwards, dead drunk. And that got a small titter from the audience. But acting dead drunk, not being dead drunk. Anyway, so I couldn't believe it, because when I played that part in the audition, I was getting laughs, and I thought, oh, I've got it. And then they said to my agent, no, he's got it completely wrong. No, we don't want him. And then somebody, I think it was the producer, actually got back in touch with my agent and said, well, what Paul did that was wrong was he completely misunderstood what the play is like. And my agent said, well, apparently you only gave him one page. How is he supposed to know what the play? So they said, right, we'll give him the play and we'll give him another audition. So I did another audition and the rest is history.
He went from, did he do art to Macbeth and Hamlet and King Lear during your career? Quite remarkable, wasn't it?
I played, I can never remember whether it's Edgar or Edmund.
Edmund, you played?
Edmund.
Yeah.
In King Lear.
Yes.
And then I did Romeo with the young Vic.
I did Hamlet
at Ludlow Festival. And I played Mark Antony in Julius Caesar at the Ludlow Festival.
Amazing.
As well. So I did quite a lot of Shakespeare and then some Shaw as well. And so, and Ennui, French playwright. So And people think I went straight from the group into musicals. Actually, I'd done most of that stuff before I ever did a musical.
Yes. What about Privilege, the movie? Did you like that?
I always say that that actually predated the start of my acting career.
Right.
I kind of enjoyed it in the way that kids might enjoy finding a hamper of old clothes in the attic and sort of, you know, dressing up in them and making up stories. But it wasn't, I hadn't got it. I mean, I did not know what I was doing, to be honest.
Then you did Cats and Pump Boys and Dinettes and Joseph. You did lots of high-profile musicals, didn't you?
Yes, well, I suppose the highest profile was Guys and Dolls at the National.
Yes.
Which I wasn't in the original cast. I took over from Ian
Charlson. Great songs, aren't they? Great songs, you know.
It's a wonderful, wonderful score. Frank Lesser is to this day a very underrated songwriter, in my opinion, but lots of other people's opinion as well. Partly because of one particular person who absolutely rubbished the score of Guys and Dolls and said there was only one good song in it, which was the sort of pastiche Irish folk song that the Salvation Army
sang. Yes, I remember it well. Yeah.
Velvet, I could wish you for the collar of your coat, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Velvet, I could wish you for the collar of your coat. I don't think so.
I know you've got a show to do tonight. I just want to mention, obviously, 32 years at least on Radio 2, didn't you? Amazing.
Yes. Well, actually...
A bit longer?
I did more than that, because before I even did Radio 2, I did the BBC World Service for about 3 years. And, of course, I did Jazz FM for 14 years in the middle of those.
And you did GLR for a while, didn't you?
I did a couple of years on GLR. I did a programme called Your Vicar Wouldn't Like It. Radio London, as it's now called. I'm very fond of Radio London. there are some presenters on Radio London who I think are absolutely top flight. And it should be listened to by even more people. But I massively enjoyed my radio career. I'm not sure if it's completely over now, but it's certainly over for the time being.
Right. Beat the Teacher? Is that coming back or not?
No, I think I was an out of work actor at the time. but no, it's quite fun doing Beat the Teacher. What I liked about Beat the Teacher was how often the kids actually did beat the teacher, because I suppose it really had to do with the fact that teachers had sort of linear ways of thinking, whereas the kids were sort of intuitive and lateral and just went, "Oh, that's easy, sir. You just do so and so, so and so, so and so." The teacher goes, "Oh, I suppose you're right."
You did Weekend on Granada TV, of course.
Oh, yes, now I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I was going to say it was the start of my interviewing career, but actually I'd been interviewing people on the World Service. I can remember two particular interviews I did on the World Service, Van Morrison and Al Jarreau.
Really?
And
was Van Morrison tough or not?
He was a little bit tough in those days. It was the first time I'd ever met him. And... yeah, I found that one a little bit sticky, but I'm such a fan of Van Morrison. Van Morrison, that's me. So, you know, I think I won him over in the end. But regular interviews every week on that television thing for Granada, Weekend, that really gave me the taste for it. And I'm still doing those. I'm doing a live ones at a small art centre where I live in Surrey. And so far I've done Bill Nighy, Virginia McKenna, Julie Walters, and Rick Wakeman. And I was told recently Bill Nighy wants to do it again. So
very lucky.
But anyway, I've got a list of people that I want to ask, and Bill Nighy is definitely on it. I thought he was absolute... Well, they were all wonderful. I really enjoy doing interviews.
And you were on the concept album of Evita all those years ago, weren't
you? Yes, the original studio album, yes, which was... the royalties have dwindled now to buy me a newspaper, but in the early days, it paid my mortgage, over and over and over.
My son Sean's with me today. He's a great fan of music. And his sister, my daughter Caroline, she's currently head of wardrobe on the touring version of Evita.
Oh, wow.
Which is still going well, and it's going all over the world.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was a wonderful piece. It was a brilliant stroke, actually, of Tim Rice, I think.
Yeah.
To have the idea to do that on the heels of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Telling me.
Well, they both worked.
Just before you go, were you a travelling salesman for records?
Maybe? I was.
Was that easy or not?
Yes. When I came down or got sent down or never went back, dropped out, whatever it was, of university, I desperately wanted to do something in the music business, preferably sing and play the harmonica. But those openings were not quite there. But I met somebody, it was a friend of mine, a wonderful piano player, who I did actually get to record with at one time, a guy called Robin Benwell Palmer. He dropped that rather aristocratic-sounding name and shortened himself to Ben Palmer.
Right.
And he was absolutely tremendous blues pianist. Anyway, he said to me, Esquire Records, which was a jazz record label, and I had quite a bit of their product in my own collection, he said, they're looking for a traveling salesman in the London area. He said, my friend, and I can't remember the other man's name, but Ben had a friend who was traveling salesman for Esquire Records, but only outside London. And for some reason, he didn't want to do London. So they were looking for somebody who would do London. And I traipsed all over London. I didn't drive. I did the whole thing on buses and tubes and whatnot, and Shanks's pony. And I used to go round to record shops, not carrying the actual product, but carrying the record sleeves. These were the days of LPs. Mm. You didn't have CDs yet. That was long in the future.
Yes.
And I used to put out these, I had a briefcase of them, and I'd open the briefcase and take out all these vinyl LP covers and spread them out on this guy's counter and say, look, this is all the stuff that we've got. And there was Miles Davis and Sonny Rollins and Thelonious Monk and a modern jazz quartet. It was just, it was awesome music. And you wouldn't believe some of the offensive things that some of those guys said to me and where I could go with my music.
Really?
Racist things always, yeah.
Paul, you're still touring with the Manfreds, which has brought you to the Isle of Wight. And, of course, the blues band you're involved with heavily, aren't you?
Yes, in fact...
You've got a new album, haven't you?
I started. It wouldn't be here if I hadn't. But that was actually at the end of a complete decade of acting. 69, the two one-act plays with Charles Marowitz, followed by Conduct Unbecoming. All the way up to 79, I came out of, I can't remember, something. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I've got to play music. I think actually 79 was a tour of Joseph. Got to play music. And I rang Tom McGuinness, who had been with me in the Manfreds. And I said, would you be interested in a blues band that I'm getting together? And he said, I could be. I don't want to work every night. So I said, no, won't work every night. I'm doing theatre 6 nights a week. So one night a week is the most it will ever work. Well, within a matter of a few weeks, we were working every night. But Tom didn't mind then because it was going so well. And then we had Huey Flint, who was his friend from McGuinness Flint. And then we found ourselves Dave Kelly and Gary Fletcher, and that was the band.
Wonderful. Can I thank you for your time? You're always a pleasure to interview because you're one of the nice guys in the business.
I've also got one of the best memories.
You certainly have. So you've got these new albums re-released of the Manfreds and on vinyl, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I know the blues band have got a new album as well, haven't
they? New album. It's called The Rooster Crowed, because Tom has a song on it called The Rooster Crowed in Memphis. And I've got, Dave Kelly sings four, I sing four, Tom sings two, Gary Fletcher sings two, and that's a dozen. And that's the thing. Two of Dave's and one of mine, I think, have their origins elsewhere, but the other nine are all originals from inside the band. And to my way of thinking, it's one of the best things we've done.
I know you do your Christian talks as well, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And we sing.
Yes.
That's a whole other thing,
yes.
Singing another kind of music altogether, really. Although, actually, some of it's related. It's still music of black origin a lot of the time.
Is it?
But, old gospel songs from Southern Baptist churches and all that sort of stuff. But modern gospel as well. But even the modern gospel comes from people like Denise Williams and... Fred Hammond and people like that. So, yeah, it's nice.
Because you work with your wife.
Yes, all with my wife. She sometimes does it without me because I'm on the road with one or other band, but I never do them without her because
she sings awfully well as well.
We met at the National Theatre in 1982, married in 1984.
Still together.
So this December, it'll be 34 years. Don't believe anybody who says show business marriages don't work.
Finally, when you sort of broke big with Manfred Mann right back in around about 63, the main big hit started, didn't they? You could never have dreamed that the next century, well, into the next century, you'd still be singing. Did you look for a long career or not?
No,
really?
I did.
You did? Oh,
no,
well.
You see, my role models were people like Sonny Boy Williamson.
Right.
I mean, I know he never saw 70, but I mean, some of those guys like Honey Boy Edwards and Pinetop Perkins and stuff, they were well into their 90s when they left. And I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to do this, you know, what do you call it? Flash in the pan business. I'm going to be here forever. And I never, ever thought that I wouldn't be. Not for a minute.
And you've got no plans to finish, have you?
No, not at all. In fact, thank you for saying finish, because I hate the R word.
Yes, yes. And we're not far off each other in age, and I've certainly got no plans. People say to me, when are you going to retire? Why? You know, coming to meet you, and in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to Rita Tushingham's house. So, you know,
wonderful.
Nice
wonderful.
Bonus, isn't it?
A taste
Why
of
start
honey.
Working? Yes, exactly.
Yeah, lovely. Paul, well, you're trim. You know, you're in good shape for a long life.
Yes, so are you, aren't you?
Yeah.
Shall we go for a run in a minute?
I can't be bothered. I'll get my exercise on
yes,
stage.
Yes, I know you do. Paul, lots of luck in the future. And as I said earlier, it's a real pleasure always to talk to you.
And it is for me too. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
It's great. He's got a swell personality. He meets and greets the stars with such amenity. Good enough to make you coming out of the street. John Hannamy. That's right.
You've been listening to John Hannah Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.